Okay, well, welcome to class two of Copernicus and the Jews. The topic today, as you know, is Parlez-vous Jewish Greek. And since it's a question, maybe I should ask for a show of hands. So let me just ask, Parlez-vous Jewish Greek? It's all Greek to some of us, okay. Well, we'll get into that later. I just want to mention that the material is a little bit complicated, as you may have noticed, so hopefully we can break it down and it should be understandable for everyone. But just in case it gets a little bit heavy or difficult, keep in mind that the person you want to blame for this is Bobby.
I didn't write this thing.
First of all, he's the one who invited me to speak.
That's true.
And secondly, it's going to be his job to keep it light. So that's not my job, that's going to be his job. So if it gets heavy and tedious, you can just blame Bobby, don't blame me. Alright. You don't mind that job, do you?
No.
Okay. Well, I actually wanted to start off by answering a very good question that someone had last time, I think it might have been Barry, about how the analogy between Copernicus and the biblical understanding that we're discussing originally arose. And I asked my dad, and he told me how he originally got this idea of Copernicus and the Jews. He was invited to speak at a pastor's conference in Poland. Now, you may know that Copernicus was himself Polish. So my father was looking for ways to make his message relevant to the people in Poland, and this is one of the ways that he came up with, to speak about Copernicus and the contributions of Copernicus, which all Polish people would know and would hold dear. And he also spoke at that same conference on the question of whether Poland exists or not. And he focused on things such as the partitions at the end of the 18th century that brought an end to Poland, and the fact that the national poet is a man named Adam Mickiewicz, who is actually a Lithuanian Jew. So there are all of these different contradictions in Polish identity, and he used it as an analogy for Jewish identity in Israel. So that's how the actual title and analogy that we discussed last time arose, for those of you who are interested. Now, because we are moving on to the second chapter, I think it would be a good idea just to ask someone quickly to restate a little bit of what we did last time. What did you get out of last week?
Well, we don't know what we really think we know.
Okay. Well, that's a good thing to get out of it, and it's actually related to the issue of Greek and the Greek language, because you may have read the works of Socrates at some point, and the works of Plato that speak about Socrates, and if so, you may remember that Socrates was put to death for claiming something very interesting. He said that he was told that he was the wisest of all men, and he didn't understand this. So he went out searching to try to discover what this could possibly mean, that he was wiser than other people, because he didn't think that he really was. So he questioned shopkeepers and poets and artisans and other people. And what he discovered, in his words, was that they thought they knew a lot, but they really didn't. Whereas he didn't even think he knew a lot. So from that, he developed the idea that he actually was wiser, because what he didn't know, he didn't even think he knew. So hopefully we can all imitate that. But I think we probably got something more out of last week as well. Someone else want to give a brief resume of the main point of chapter 1?
Well, there was the church has always held that, different perspective, and it's been a stumbling block for the Jews. The church has made a different center, if you may, and it doesn't make sense. You know, just like the ancient astronomers, Ptolemy and those that followed, made the earth the center of the system, and the church thought it was the center of the system, that it replaced the Jews. Well, you had some sort of, in astronomy, you had something going like this, you know, like for the planets, the inner planets, and the other planets did other things.
Right.
And Copernicus just wanted to see the simplest solution, and he assumed that the earth could may not be the center, and he figured out what would happen if he said the sun was the center, and presto.
Right. Yeah,
so we're, to relate this back to the Jews, we're trying to see what the center is, which I believe is the Word of God. And from there on we go.
Okay, thank you.
Well, what I have written down is that it was the most revolutionary scientific event that changed the entire world, because the Copernicus Revolution led to the Industrial Age and raised the standard of living for the entire world, and it led to Enlightenment and all kinds of other things. And then we talked a lot about what happened in the timeline as far as removing the Jews, like at the Nicaea Council and stuff, and what happened in the second century with the Jewish believers being removed from Judaism for belief in Yeshua. And the third century, they had the bishops and the Word of God. It changed everything. Constantine had changed everything about the religion.
Okay, yeah. So what develops actually is a Christian system that is itself not centered on the proper center. It has a lot of explanations, just as the astronomers of Copernicus's day had a lot of explanations for why the planets didn't match up as they were supposed to. But it doesn't actually explain the existence of the Jewish people and God's plans for the Jewish people. So starting this week, we're actually going to begin to look at some of the specific ways in which the system of Christianity doesn't match up, and maybe some of the ways in which we can come to a better understanding. And at the foundation of this is Jewish Greek. Now, if anyone didn't get the handout from last time, I do have a few extra copies, so just raise your hand if you need that. Okay. Now, your challenge, if you weren't here last week, is going to be to try to figure out how all of the quotes on this handout are actually related to the topic we were discussing. Well, again, I'll repeat the title for today, which is Parlez-vous Jewish Greek. This title also is, a little bit of a joke, although maybe an inside joke, just as Copernicus and the Jews is a little bit humorous in the way that it's phrased. There is a member of my extended family who, in traveling to Quebec, wanted to discover if she could speak English with someone. So she opened the door of a cafe or a bar or some establishment like that and poked her head in, and the words that came out of her mouth were, "Parlez-vous français?" And so, of course, everyone inside just looked at her in astonishment, and she became very embarrassed and shut the door and went out and didn't go back into that particular cafe. And the question that we're examining today, Parlez-vous Jewish Greek, is similar in some ways, because it's the kind of question that maybe seems absurd to some of us in our modern perspective. But if we were to be in the context of those times, it would seem absurd for the opposite reasons. In other words, it would be like asking a French-speaking person if they spoke French, because we're talking about actually what's termed the Hellenistic period in Jewish history. You may remember the story of the Maccabees and how the introduction of Hellenistic thought and government and culture and religion and science created great divisions within the Jewish community. How many people have actually read the books of the Maccabees? Okay. Does anyone remember how it starts out? It doesn't actually start out with the famous story of Modin and how Mattathias refuses to sacrifice.
Is that the one in the Apocrypha?
Yeah.
It is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It starts out with Alexander conquering the New World, I think.
Okay. And then as it starts to tell the story of the Jews, the first type of conflict that it describes is between the Hellenic Jews, the Hellenized Jews, and the Hebraic Jews. There were some Jews at this time who wanted to adopt Hellenic practice to an extreme degree, to even to the point of abandoning Torah and Jewish practices commanded by God. And there were others who resisted this, who wanted to remain faithful to Torah. And the Hellenistic period continued for a long period of time. We could say it continues through the Roman era in that Hellenistic culture or Greek culture, so to speak, becomes part of just the general culture of at least the eastern half of the Roman Empire. So it continues for some centuries. And in this time period, when you have the continuation of the Hellenistic period of Jewish history, you have the whole spectrum among Jewish people of those who completely abandon their Jewishness and want to adopt exclusively Greek practices and rituals, and those who want to completely repudiate any adoption of Hellenistic practice, language, religion, and so forth. So there's an entire spectrum, but it's termed the Hellenistic period because no one could escape this influence of the Greek culture. And what I mean when I say that there's a spectrum is that in the middle you have various ways of mixing the two worlds. You have a combination of the Hellenistic world and the Hebraic world. This affects even the rabbis, for example, much later on. The works of the Talmud, as they're compiled, include evidence of influence from Greek, both the Greek language, Greek ideas of logic, and so forth. So in other words, the basic context of this period is one in which every Jew has some exposure to the Greek world and some understanding of Hellenism. And what will be argued as we go through this chapter is that, in fact, the language that the Messianic writings or the writings about Yeshua are written in is a language that represents a hybrid language that is part of this process of combining the Hellenistic and the Hebraic world in the period of the first century. Now, that's the reason I say that the question would be maybe incomprehensible to people of the time, because of course all the time they were speaking and interacting in this hybrid culture. But for us, it's a very distant thing, so we have to do some work to try to uncover it. I think that it is actually a complicated topic, but for some people, at least, I think it has the potential also to really change your life in a significant manner, and to change your understanding of yourself and of God. I think I would say that it has done that for me. Just the ability to understand Jewish Greek and how that should influence our understanding of the scriptures. Why is this the case? Well, if you're a Jew, you know that our identity as a people has something to do with God and Torah and the scriptures that he revealed to us supernaturally by his spirit. That's the claim that's made throughout Tanakh. And so the consequence of that, or one of the consequences of that, is that if any other revelation comes that does not agree with Tanakh, that does not line up with the revelation that God already gave to Israel, then it needs to be discarded. In other words, if someone comes along and claims to be speaking for God, claims to be a prophet, but they're saying to worship other gods, that person is to be disregarded, as the Torah says. And this could apply to any of the other religious books in the world as well. One of the things that God requires of Jews is that in looking at other revelations that purport to be from God, we have to compare it to Tanakh. And if it doesn't match up, then we would have to discard it, whether it's a book claimed by Muslims or Buddhists or Hindus or what have you to be true. And the same applies equally to what Christians call the New Testament. If it does not match up with Tanakh, then every Jew should disregard it and should not consider it worthy of acceptance. And in fact, should be opposed to this book. Now, here's where Jewish Greek actually makes a very significant difference in our understanding. With many contemporary translations in English, in Spanish, in French, in Russian, in all of the languages of the modern world, the New Testament contains passages which do not seem to coincide very well with Tanakh, or which do not appear to be consistent with a Jewish understanding that is defined in Tanakh. This creates a problem for those of us who actually believe that Yeshua is the Messiah and that these are the words of God. In some cases, for some people, they might find it to be an irresolvable conflict. For example, one of the most famous or infamous such instances would, of course, be what's called the anti-Semitic perspective of the Gospels. This is something that many Jews believe to be the case, that the Gospels have an anti-Semitic slant to them, that they speak against the Jewish people and they speak against Israel, and even advocate hatred of the Jewish people. Now, if this were the case, then the New Testament, or the writings about Yeshua, would not be a document worthy of our consideration. So if these things are actually true, we would have to discard those texts. Fortunately, it's not the case, and when one has the understanding of Jewish Greek, it becomes very obvious why it's not the case and also why it appears to be the case. So it almost answers two major questions at once. It explains why Christians have interpreted the New Testament in that way throughout history, and it also explains what the correct interpretation should be. I think you might agree with me that this is a fairly important matter to consider. And the basic argument is that in its context, with consideration of the actual language of the text, the writings about Yeshua make perfect sense, and many of these major and minor apparent disjunctions with Tanakh simply disappear. I'll give you an example of another one that might seem to be minor, but which will come up later in the book, and that has to do with the discussion in Hebrews about the testator and the testament and how someone has to die for a testament to be in force and so forth. And it's very complicated and strange, and no one really understands what's going on, and it doesn't seem to refer to anything that we have in Tanakh. Well, the problem is that the translators did not have an understanding of the basic Jewish Greek context within which these texts were written. And as you read in this chapter, they translated these texts as if they were translating Christian documents written in Christian Greek. Well, there were no Christians at the time of the composition of these documents, or very, very few. And there was no Christian Greek at that time. So that's an erroneous assumption, and it's a wrong way of attempting to translate. And so what happens in those particular passages that cannot be understood from the, let's say, Christian Greek perspective, is that translators will attempt to fix the text in some way to bring some sort semblance of meaning to the text. Unfortunately, that meaning may not be the correct meaning. And so with Jewish Greek, what we're trying to do is simply to go back into history and to look at the language and the culture and the context of that period, and to see what the words of the original actually meant and how they may differ from some of our translations. So, any questions or comments on that? Did anyone view the major thesis of chapter 2 any differently, or can you sum it up in a more concise way?
No, I just mentioned that when you mentioned New Testament, it's not a testament. The actual thing is a Brit, which is a covenant.
Yeah.
So it could be considered a new covenant.
Okay, yes. And, of course, the resolution of that chapter, of that passage in Hebrews, has everything to do with understanding what a covenant is, what plit is, as opposed to a testament, which is not what's implied. But the translators understood testament because that's the typical meaning of the word in ordinary Greek, not in Jewish Greek. So that's why they misunderstood the passage. But it's very easy to show that this is actually a reference to a Hebraic covenant, if we compare to other texts that are written in the same language. And of course, the either term testament or covenant is not a good description for these texts as a whole, for these writings as a whole. That's part of the Christian understanding that arose from the second century on. A covenant is a specific contract and a specific agreement, and the new covenant, if we want to speak about that, is found in Jeremiah. It's found in Tanakh. So it's not the name of these writings about Yeshua.
Yeah, there's certain idioms that appear in the New Testament that are, you know, in ancient Greek, they didn't make any sense. However, these idioms show up in the Tanakh.
Right, that's a very good point. Now, I'm going to skip ahead to something I was planning to say later because of Fred's point. And this is just an object lesson. Here's what I consider to be one of the very best proofs of the existence of Jewish Greek. This is the Greek-English lexicon of Liddell and Scott. It's the standard lexicon of ancient Greek. It's not the full version. It's the intermediate version. The full version is much larger and is the standard work on the Greek language. But if you just flip through this lexicon, you will find places over and over again, hundreds of places, where you see the letters NT, which stand for New Testament. And the reason you see that is because in multiple definitions, the Greek word means one thing in classical sources like Homer or in later sources that are in what's called Koine or Common Greek, but it means something else in the New Testament. And that's why they remark every time New Testament. In fact, I just opened up by chance to page 147, and here I see already barotimos, a word that appears only in the New Testament. I see down here another word that has several meanings in Plato and Herodotus and Aristotle and other classical sources, but has a different meaning, slightly different meaning, not very different, in what they term the New Testament. I see a third one that has basically the same meaning in classical texts and in the New Testament. So if you just open up a standard work on the Greek language, you can already see the reason for this theory or the necessity of this theory of Jewish Greek, because the language of what's called the New Testament or the Messianic writings is not the same as any other Greek language. And this is recognized universally. What's not recognized universally is what to call it, to what extent it represents a new language as opposed to a dialect or interference from Hebraic concepts and so forth. But the fact that there is something going on is unavoidable.
So would it be accurate to say that the Messianic writings were written in the same vein as the Septuagint?
Yes, and this is going to be a key to understanding what the text actually means. Because the Septuagint is the text that actually invents this language, if you will. And why does it invent this language?
To help spread the deeper meaning to a different race or a different culture and different language-based people.
Okay.
To help Hellenistic Jews to understand the Tanakh.
Okay, yes. There are two different theories about the composition of the Septuagint. One of them is that it was a translation for Hellenistic Jews who no longer spoke Hebrew. That, in other words, it was a translation for Jews. Another theory is that it was actually commissioned by a Gentile ruler of Alexandria to translate the scriptures so that Gentiles could read it in Greek. But in either case, what happens is that you have the Tanakh, which is written in Hebrew and Aramaic, which has to be rendered into Greek for what becomes both a Jewish and a Gentile audience. Now, Hebrew and Greek are very different languages and very different cultures, and although I'm not convinced that it's 100% correct, all throughout history, people have viewed Hebrew and Greek civilization as opposites, as polar opposites. So when you have to translate a text from Hebrew into Greek, there are going to be very significant problems, and we had actually a quotation in this chapter that that pointed to this. I don't have it marked, so it will take me a moment to find it, but it's on page 23.
On the bottom.
It's right in the middle of page 23 is the one I was referring to. Do you have another one, Charlie?
I was thinking of in Matthew, but go ahead.
Okay. So this is a rather prominent quotation on the task of translation. Very interesting. I think this is one that's actually appended to the introduction of modern editions of the Septuagint. And this particular translator from Hebrew into Greek says the following: things once expressed in Hebrew do not have the same force in them when put into another language. And not only this book, but the law itself, the Torah, in other words, and the prophecies and the rest of the books differ not a little in translation from the original. So what is he saying here? He's saying that the Greek translation of Tanakh does not capture its essence, that it sounds very different in the Greek language. That's the first thing to notice, that there was no real way of expressing Hebrew concepts in the Greek language. The two languages were just too different. Their concepts were too different. Nonetheless, the Septuagint was made. The translation was done. And what resulted was a kind of hybrid language. Now, the Septuagint had many different translators working on it. The theory is that there were 70 or 72. That's why it's called the Septuagint. Septuagint meaning 70. Certainly, if you read it, it would seem like there were a lot of different people translating it, because the styles of translation vary significantly. And as is mentioned in the chapter that you read for tonight, the Septuagint has its own problems as a translation, not the least of which would be chapters that aren't in the Hebrew version and things like that. So it's not a straightforward problem. But nonetheless, you can, if you compare the Septuagint to the Tanakh, the Hebrew version, you can see exactly what went on in the process of translation. And it's extremely interesting. One of the most famous or most consequential choices that we'll obviously be focusing on tonight is the question of how to translate the Hebrew word Mashiach. Fred, you said I could ask you the Hebrew question. So what is Mashiach?
It comes from the root Mashah, which means to anoint.
Okay.
In modern Hebrew, you have Mishka, which is ointment.
Do I have it right here?
Mashiach, yeah, that's good.
All right. So, what does this term signify in Tanakh?
The anointed one of God.
It does signify the anointed one of God. Could you give me an example?
Like King Saul and King David.
Oh. Exactly. Like King Saul, like King David, like the high priest, they were all anointed of God. They were all termed Mashiach Adonai, the anointed of the Lord.
Was Joshua Mashiach Adonai, the warrior? I don't think so.
I'm not sure. We could find out. Yeah. But I think that there's... I don't think he's termed that specifically, although I might be wrong. But even if he's not termed that, I think you can see there's an element of God's anointing on him in a figurative sense. But that's a good question. It would be a very interesting study to go through the scriptures and see who is actually termed Mashiach Adonai. But some examples that we know for sure would be Saul and David. That's why David would not lift up his hand against Saul, even when Saul was trying to kill him. He said, "Far be it from me to smite the anointed of the Lord, Mashiach Adonai." Later in the Psalms, David refers to himself as Mashiach Adonai, and these are some of them we think of as messianic prophecies also, that they point to a greater Mashiach of the Lord.
And King Cyrus in Isaiah 45.
Exactly. Yeah. King Cyrus, who is termed Mashiach of the Lord, even though he is not physically anointed. All the other ones were physically anointed with oil as a sign of God's authority and of God's anointing on them, God giving them the ability and the authorization to do a particular task. Mm-hmm. So there are many, many places in the Bible where this word appears. And it appears over and over. It is not reserved, as in English today, in the transliteration Messiah. it was not reserved only for the Messiah. It referred to a lot of different people. By the way, is everyone clear on the difference between translation and transliteration? Someone who's clear on it, could you express it for us?
Translation is something that's directly, you know, let's say word for word, whereas a transliteration is more of a pronunciation of, you know, transposing a writing.
Okay, yeah, to translate something means to carry it across, to carry it over from one language to another in this particular case. To transliterate means to carry over the letters.
That's what you have on the board as a transliteration.
Exactly. This is a translate. Both of these are transliterations. Mm-hmm. This is a better transliteration because it gives you a closer approximation of the Hebrew. But this is the M, this is SH, and this is the H sound. So that's what's reproduced here in the transliteration. That's what's also reproduced here in Messiah, just with some anglicization to make it easier for English speakers.
Hellenization. The Greeks can't say an SH.
Yes, although that's what we'll consider next, what actually happens in the Jewish-Greek version. Now, in the case of the Septuagint, or in rendering in Greek, a lot of Hebrew words they did transliterate. And so, in other words, they couldn't find a Greek equivalent, so they just put the Greek letters that corresponded to the Hebrew letters and made up a new word. In the same way as if you put Mashiach or Tevila or Teshuva in an English document today. Those are all transliterations. In other cases, they tried to find a close equivalent in the Greek. And in multiple cases, and this is maybe the most interesting type of example, they took a concept that existed in Greek that had a different meaning, and they adapted it for use in the Septuagint, for use in expressing Hebrew concepts. And that's why you have something unique called Jewish Greek, because the words that are Greek are used in a different way. So what did the translators of the Septuagint do in all of the places where they encountered this Hebrew word Mashiach?
Christos.
They used the Greek word Christos. Which meant what?
Smeared
with oil.
Like a shield.
Like a leather shield that you want to keep from cracking or drying out. So it was a pre-existing word that had a meaning in the Greek context. It was something that was an action that was done. And it corresponded to the most basic literal meaning of the Hebrew Mashiach, to actually have someone put oil on you. Of course, the Hebrew Mashiach meant more. It meant the authorization of God, the ability from God, and so forth. Christos did not mean this in Greek. But it had a correspondence. There was the correspondence on the most basic level. And one thing that my father argues in this chapter is that if Christos had had all those additional meanings, if it had been associated with some god, for example, it could not have been used, because that would have distorted the message mm-hmm. of Mashiach Adonai. But since it was only a simple word that had a very physical meaning, the meaning could be expanded and be imbued with a new significance. So in Jewish Greek, or in the Septuagint, if we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, Christos is the Greek word that's used to translate Mashiach. Keep in mind, this is about 200 years before Yeshua. So what you have is a situation in which Jews and Gentiles who read the scriptures in Greek begin to have this concept of Christos, which is very different from the general Greek conception of Christos. You would say it's a kind of a different dialect. It's a kind of a different use of language. And this continues, obviously, through the whole Hellenistic period. The argument that's made in the chapter on Parlez-vous Jewish Greek, which you all will by the end of the day, I assume, is that this language that was created at this time in order to convey Hebrew concepts in the Greek language is the same language in which the writings about Yeshua, the Messianic writings, what Christians call the New Testament, was written itself. And that if one wants to understand it, therefore, you have to understand it in exactly this context. So whenever you read Christos, for example, just to take the one word that we put up on the board, you have to understand that what's meant is Mashiach. You can't think that it's talking about anything else that you might get from earlier or later Greek culture. In other words, you have to recognize this correspondence. And there are lots and lots of these pairs of words that should be recognized for proper translation. Any questions on that scheme or any comments on it?
What was Mashiach a widely recognized term among Hellenized Jews and Hebraic Jews at that time?
Well, Jews who were familiar with the scriptures would know about Mashiach because it's in the scriptures.
But the Hellenized Jews at that time didn't know anything about Mashiach?
Well, I wouldn't say that exactly. I think it depends on who you're talking about. Like I said at the beginning, there was a whole spectrum from the most Hebraic to the most Hellenic, most Hellenized. The most Hellenized who completely abandoned Judaism might not have been familiar with certain Jewish concepts like this. But those in the middle, which would have been the majority of the population, would have some idea.
It just seems bizarre that they didn't just transliterate Mashiach into Greek.
Okay, I mean, it wouldn't convey anything. See, keep in mind also that, like for us today, Messiah, which is a transliteration, it has a lot of meaning. Now, it's not exactly the same as the original meaning. But if I asked you to define Messiah, what would you say?
Savior. Jesus.
Chosen one.
The chosen one of God, the one who's supposed to bring peace to the world, who's supposed to redeem his people, who's supposed to be a suffering servant like Joseph was, to fulfill all of the prophecies about the Messiah in Judaism today, of whatever form, there's a very strong understanding of the Messiah. Mm-hmm. So we have that notion. But there was no such understanding at the time. And in fact, it's a very debatable question to try to understand, even among the most Hebraic Jews, what their understandings of the Messiah would be. It's argued back and forth by many scholars because we don't really know for this period before Yeshua what the messianic expectations were, so to speak. We know what some of them were, but again, keep in mind that in these terms, as the Messiah, the scriptures do not put together the whole package. For example, some of the messianic prophecies that you're most familiar with speak of the Messiah as my servant, or my servant the branch, or the root of Jesse. They use other terms, in other words. So to what extent the whole picture had been put together is a matter of great debate. But there was messianic expectation. There was the expectation that some great servant of God would arise at the time, and this word actually carried some meaning that was associated with all of the other people in Tanakh who had been anointed by God. So I can't answer that question because in some other cases the translators of the Septuagint did in fact transliterate, like I said. So it's just a judgment call what they decided to do and what they didn't decide to do. But if I were to speculate, I would say they wanted to make sure that this original meaning of the word was carried over. In other words, it was not a name at that point in time. It was not the Messiah. It was an actual, real concept that applied to many different people, and they wanted to maintain that meaning. To just transliterate it, whenever you transliterate, you run the risk of losing the meaning, because the people in the other language have no idea what that word means. So they don't. If they knew Hebrew, they would read it in Hebrew. But they don't know what Mashiach is. That's why you're translating it. So when you translate, you have to decide, well, what's the best way I can communicate this? And apparently this is what they thought was the best way at that time.
Yeah, and also Ptolemy wouldn't have understood what Mashiach was, but he'd understand what Christos was, you know, in the Hellenistic Greek world. I mean, you have Gentiles reading this, too.
Right. He would understand what Christos meant in the physical sense. He would have no idea of any of this. But at least if you give him a word Christos, it gives him something to relate to. If you just transliterate Mashiach, he doesn't have a clue what it means in any way whatsoever. So, again, I can't say whether they were right or wrong or whether it was the best choice or not, but that's the kind of thought process that would go into these choices. Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, it seems like the information in this book, especially, okay, you could just say even the information in this chapter, is like a big, deep, dark secret that needs to be revealed.
Yeah.
That is so hidden from the church world, mm-hmm. if you want to put it that way. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like how to get that information out to a broad group of people.
That's a good question. I'll let you answer that question, I think. But that is in a sense, what we're doing. I mean, of course, if you want to get a message of any kind out to a group of people, you have to first understand it and know about it yourself. So hopefully this evening will help us with regard to this particular issue. And as I mentioned, the issue of Jewish-Greek lays the foundation for many other issues that are discussed later on in the book. And the book is only a selection of the issues that could be discussed along the same theme, or along the same line.
This could be another book, right?
Yeah, this says volume one.
Yes, indeed. And if you weren't here last time, I mentioned that I'm no longer taking questions on when volume two is coming out. You'll have to sign up for my dad's newsletter to find out about that.
You have to give us an email.
I did on the handout from last time. You have the information about how to sign it.
When you said on that handout to give Bob our address, did you mean our email address or our mail?
Your physical address, your mailing address, yeah.
Okay.
Let me just ask before I go on if there are any specific questions about the material in the chapter that you had, so that we can be sure to cover them.
I was really struck by the concept of sharing the avoka and the machti with mm-hmm. you know, the Hindi as well as
avatur.
And with the Muslims, I have used the machti terminology with Muslims before.
Mm-hmm.
And I stood to be corrected in reading the book, but yet I felt like I was being understood, and now I'm realizing I wasn't understood at all.
No.
Well, one of the ways of showing that you weren't understood would be on the handout from last time, actually. If you remember the quote about Islam that I included,
yeah.
It gives a prevailing view of the Mahdi, sometimes also a view of Jesus. Mm-hmm. They were seen as interchangeable here. In medieval Islam, that was just commonly believed.
Right.
That you couldn't challenge from within the system. That's what we used it as an example of last time. But the quote is that it was commonly held that Jesus would return at the end of times to complete the task, in other words, of subjugating the non-Muslims, by breaking crosses, killing swine, destroying churches and synagogues, and converting the people of the book by persuasion or the sword. Or the Mahdi would see to it that everyone on earth became either a Muslim or a tributary, this being how God would fulfill his promise to make Islam prevail over all religion. So within the system of Islam, there is a meaning associated with Mahdi and what he's expected to do. It's sort of a Messiah-like figure who comes. That's why Charlie could latch on to that as something that might, you know, help in relating. But the problem is that it's integrally linked to what they consider to be the revelation of Islam. Mm. So it would be as if Christos already had an association with some Greek god or goddess. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be very worthwhile to use it as an equivalent for Mashiach.
Right.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
I have a hard time really seeing what the problem is with Christ.
Okay.
I got the impression that your father was suggesting that it is a linguistic problem.
Mm-hmm.
But as I read on, it seems more like a historical problem.
Yes.
I mean, it's not a connotative problem, it's a connotative.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for using those terms. Can you explain what they mean?
Is it just a identify? It's incorrect in its... in identifying an object or an idea. Connotative meaning it has associations.
Mm-hmm.
The meaning has different associations. Whereas denotative would be an objective label.
Okay. Yeah, I think when you look at any word, there are three levels of meaning, or I like to think of it this way at least. First is the etymology, the etymological meaning of the word. So, for example, what is the etymological meaning of the word Pentecost?
Pentecost.
50?
Gives a historical definition.
Right. The etymology means the root meaning of the word. It means 50. The word just means 50, according to the etymology. Mm-hmm. What would be a denotation or the dictionary definition of Pentecost?
50 days after Passover?
Okay, yes. 50 days after Passover, the Feast of Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks. 49 days plus 1 is 50.
Yeah.
So it's an actual Jewish festival.
Every year.
And it's also a Christian festival. What are some of the connotations of Pentecost?
The day of the Holy Spirit came.
Yeah.
Right. This would be mostly in the Christian realm. The connotation would have something to do with however that particular Christian group interprets the events of Acts 2 mm-hmm. and the revealing of the Holy Spirit in flames of fire and so forth. Mm-hmm. So every word carries these layers of meaning. Mm-hmm. And Christos, more than most, we could say. The root meaning is krio, to smear. And for our purposes, we'll act as if, I guess, in a sense, it's already been brought into Jewish Greek. You could look at each word, I guess, at a different point in history. But let's say it's already been brought into Jewish Greek. So what would be the denotation or the definition of Christos?
Anointed.
The anointed one. Could even be the anointed one of God, since we're talking about Jewish Greek. Mm-hmm. Now, eventually this becomes Christ in English and in other languages, Christos, whatever. Mm-hmm. What are the connotations of that term?
The Gentile Messiah.
The Gentile God. It could even go further and say, one of the three gods that the Christians worship from a Jewish perspective throughout history. The enemy of the Jews, exactly. The one who's going to destroy Jews. And we see that very often in Christian theology and in Christian presentation towards Jews throughout history. But you can see it's also in Muslim theology mm-hmm. that this Christ is going to destroy Jews. So, from a Jewish perspective, now the connotation, by the way, for other people is different. If you stop your typical evangelical Christian on the street, and maybe we have people like this here in the room right now, and ask them to describe Christ, they'll tell you about love and, blue eyes and blonde hair and all sorts of things, right? And those are the connotations of Christ for them. But from a Jewish perspective, the connotation of Christ is actually extremely negative. And it is linked to the historical persecution for 1700 or 1800 years by the church of the Jewish people. And Christ connotes, doesn't denote necessarily, but connotes the enemy of the Jews, the destroyer of Israel, the God of the Gentiles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a non-Jewish entity. And that's, of course, a tragedy because it was a Jewish word. Originally, it's Jewish scholars who are inventing this word to express the idea of Mashiach. Mm-hmm. But through the process of history, words change their meanings. And they develop new meanings and they accrue connotations.
Just like gay.
Yes.
That is true. Any other questions or comments or issues that you want to see addressed at some point? We don't have to address them all now. I just wanted to sort of maybe get a list up so that as we go through the rest of the material, we could be sure to cover anything that was problematic. Nothing is problematic. Great. Well, we can watch the Red Sox game now.
That's problematic.
It's in the back of my mind. The Red Sox are playing right now. They are playing right now, yeah. And they're down 2-1. I don't mean the score, I mean in the series. They're down 2-1.
That's not a yarmulke, that's a little transistor radio.
Would anyone mind if we put this TV over there?
Bobby would.
Bobby would. This is a scholarly day.
Okay, well now we can start with a clean slate because there are no problems or questions. And I want to talk about context, historical context. In makes it seem more dramatic if I write it down and it takes more time. But I mean this in a broad sense. The context for understanding the existence of Jewish Greek and why it exists. I have a book on Jewish history that says the following. Jewish history is largely the story of the fluctuations in the size and geographical distribution of the Jewish population. Did you catch that? Mm-hmm. Jewish history, in other words, to rephrase it, Jewish history can basically be inferred, it can be reduced to the quantity of people that are Jews living in particular areas.
Who wrote this?
This is a man named Barnavi, who wrote a historical atlas of the Jewish people. I'll put it up on the board if you want to. In case you want to look it up. It's commonly available. It's a good resource for all facets of Jewish history.
It's not incorrect, but it's only one piece of the history.
Okay, but what does he mean by this?
That you can track how well or how poorly we were doing by how many of us were left and where they put us.
That might be part of it. Any other ideas?
Formation and assimilation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Or if we were to take what we know about Hellenic culture, what we were saying before, can you express it in terms other than assimilation, for example?
It's the grafting of the people within the entities of society. Wherever there's an ethnos, they'll join together.
Exactly. There's a saying that Jews are like everybody else, only more so.
Yeah, they said that in Israel when there was inflation. We had the best inflation in the world.
Oh, that's something to be proud of, the best inflation in the world. But yes, I like the way Charlie describes it. Jews have been scattered throughout the world in various places at different times, and this is what Barnavi is saying, at different times, the bulk of the Jewish population has been in one place or another. At one point, the bulk of the Jewish population was in the land of Israel. In Roman times, the bulk of the Jewish population was in the Roman Empire. In later times, the bulk of the Jewish population was in Arab lands as they fell under Muslim conquest. After that, the majority of the Jewish population was in Christian lands, and particularly, as we skip forward through several centuries of history, in Eastern Europe. So, what Barnavi is saying is that you can discover everything you need to know about Jewish history by just looking at where the bulk of the Jewish population was, and you'll come to discover something very interesting, that in each of these cases, there's kind of a unique Jewish civilization that is created. And the Jewish civilization is created through the combination of native Hebrew concepts, language, understanding, art, and the local varieties of those same types of things. So one of the consequences of this is the hybridization of language, to put it in technical terms, or things like Jewish Greek. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second.
And Yiddish.
And Yiddish is another example. Ladino, exactly.
Yeah.
But it's a very general process. It includes literature, it includes art and so forth. Some of you may have heard of the Golden Age of Spain in the 10th and 11th centuries when Jewish culture and Muslim culture flourished together and were intermingled and influenced each other jointly. That period of the Golden Age of Spain was the period of Judeo-Arabic culture. Jewish Arabic. Has anyone heard of Judeo-Arabic before?
Mm-hmm.
Judeo-Arabic is the language in which Maimonides wrote, who we discussed last time. Again, these terms refer to both an entire culture or civilization, but also to a specific language. Judeo-Arabic arose when Jews began to write Arabic with Hebrew letters, and then to introduce Hebrew terms into that language. So it became a separate language of its own, with a unique place in culture, I guess you could say. Maimonides was a 12th...
compared to Aramaic.
Okay, I'll put Aramaic down too. I'll just mention that Maimonides was a 12th century Jewish thinker, philosopher, theologian, if you want. We mentioned him last time. He synthesized the works of Aristotle with the teaching. He tried to synthesize Aristotelian philosophy, ancient Greek philosophy of Aristotle, with the teachings of the Hebrew Bible to make it more rationalistic. And then in the following century, Thomas Aquinas, influenced by Maimonides, did the same thing for Christianity. And Maimonides, you may have heard of some of his works, The Guide for the Perplexed. Also, he composed the Principles of Faith that are recited in some synagogues today, and so forth. Yeah.
This is a little off topic. But when the Sephardic Jews were pushed out of Spain and Portugal, and they went into the Arabic culture, what became the dominant language there? Or were they both spoken the Judeo-Arabic and Ladino? Did they speak both, or did one take over?
Well, it's a good question. Judeo-Arabic actually was before that.
Yeah, exactly. It was there before, and then Ladino
and then,
came in.
Yeah. Now, I don't know when Ladino started to exist, but it probably started to exist simultaneously with Judeo-Arabic. Mm-hmm. Let's put down some of these hybrid languages. Bobby mentioned Jewish Aramaic, which is an ancient hybrid language found in the Messianic writings and in other sources. It's primarily the language of the Talmud. It's a hybrid between Aramaic language, which is from Babylon or Iraq, and Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And it arose when Jews were in the Babylonian exile, Babylonian captivity. They were actually in Babylon, in Iraq. So they mixed their culture and their language with Aramaic. And just, again, to illustrate the point that it's an entire civilization or cultural trend that's going on here, that language is one aspect of this. Something else that happened, apparently, when the Jews were in Babylonia is that there was a lot of incorporation of Babylonian calendrical elements. Some of the names of the months that appear later in the Bible are Babylonian names for months. And some of the ways of rectifying the solar and lunar systems may have come from Babylonia as well. So there's this whole process of hybridization of the culture, and you can see it in very ancient times in Jewish Aramaic. Judeo-Arabic, we mentioned. Someone was saying Ladino.
Yeah, from the 1400s on, I guess.
Ladino?
I would say so.
Yeah, it might have emerged before then in Christian areas of Spain. The Reconquista, or the